Remember to subscribe to our Zoom Catchers YouTube channel and follow us on our socials.
You know, tell us about your work experience with him. He's such a talented act. He was, you know, unfortunately, he passed away. Many feel too
Chadwick,
soon, but
Chadwick,
yes. Mm-hmm. So just if you could just tell our audience about your experiences working with him and training with him, that'd be awesome.
It didn't take the whole department, all the faculty long, to realize that we had somebody very precious in our department. Everybody was impressed with him. We would all talk about it at meetings. But I was lucky because he came to me and I was in charge of I was a directing advisor. I taught both acting and directing. I created the directing program because I believed that people should direct their own pieces, their own histories. And with Dr. Carol Singleton, the late Dr. Carol Singleton, I managed to get approved by the American Schools of Theater. Now, which wasn't an easy feat, but I won't go into that. But she knew the ways to do it. And so we got permission because the problem was that directing had always been taught on a master's level. And my approach was that nobody was going for a master's in directing at that time. Well, so in comes Chadwick Boseman, and he wants to talk to the directing advisor. And I meet with him in my office, and he says, well, should I major in acting or directing? So I said, what have you done in acting? Well, not much, but he tells me a few things here and there. Already his vocabulary is incredible. And already he's so well read. He's citing quotes from books and, you know, just the first last meeting with him in my office. So I said, and he has talked about this in interviews, I said, well, you know, you can always study acting while you're taking directing, because you have to take classes in acting to be a director. But if you study directing, you'll always have work and you'll always understand the structure of a piece.
Thank you so much for joining us today for another episode of Conversations on Aging. We're never too young to talk about aging. And I'm so, so pleased to have with us a legend in the theater community, and that is Professor Vera Katz. Professor Katz, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm hanging in.
Hanging in. Great. Well, you look great and it looks like the sun is beaming your way. So it looks like another great day. So I really appreciate you being on to discuss these topics of aging and your life and let our audience know more about you. So now that I've introduced you, can you tell us what is it that keeps you going after all these years in the theater? What inspiration do you draw on to keep moving forward with your career?
I'm 1 month into my 89th year. And though I'm moving slower, I find that what keeps me going is working with people younger than me. There are a lot of them, thank goodness. On monologues, on scenes, on material literature, getting them thinking, getting them to explore, getting them to risk and to trust their instincts. You know, I hear, well, I thought that, but I didn't know if I should do that. And I'm constantly saying, well, those thoughts are there because you're supposed to do that. So come on now. That's what keeps me going. I like to make changes and growth in people in terms of good theater. And that's always been my aim. It's exciting when I see change in front of me. It's exciting when I see that they understand it. They've got it. They're not going for the surface. They're going for the subtext. They're going for the meanings of the words. They're going for the playwright's theme or message. And I like to uncover that because we tend to do things rather fast in this world we live in. Everything conspires for us to do it fast. And it really takes, to be a good actor, reflection and depth, not a surface looking at the top of it. And I love it when they discover it themselves, or they add to where I pointed them to go and they got it, and then they add their own ideas. I love that. That's what keeps me going. I also find it keeps my brain working, keeps me fighting that word dementia that we all worry about at my age, and it keeps me reading new plays. I've just discovered through our class together a couple of weeks ago, Brandon Jacob Jenkins, and I've just read another play by him, and I'm going to see a play of his in New York, directed by my former student, Felicia Rashad. It's called Purpose. And so, new playwrights, that's very exciting to me. And he's a very interesting playwright. He deals with a class of Black Americans that hasn't really been dealt with in theater. He's dealing with a middle to upper middle class group of people who are educated, etc. And it's about time that we saw those people on stage. We see them in life, and we got to know who they are inside and why they're the way they are. So I find it interesting, very exciting, you know. And one of my students came in with a play she wanted to do a monologue from, and it's another one of his plays, Comeuppance. So it's very exciting, and I feel invigorated by it. So that's that, working with people, working with new playwrights, working with old plays that I didn't know about, all of that keeps me going.
Awesome. And we're going to talk more about how we've been working together and our online works that we've done and some of the plays that we've been exploring as well a little bit later on. But I do want to, you know, stick with the topic of, you know, your experience, your direct experience in the theater. I know you've been a director for quite a while. And what is it specifically, though, about education that draws you at this point in your career and educating others?
Well, I found myself unexpectedly, which now I've come to believe now that I'm older, and that's the good point about aging. You begin to see how all the little details of your life fit under a larger microism, and they've had a purpose. So I found myself unexpectedly applying or interviewing for a job at Howard University in Washington, D.C., in the Department of Theater Arts in 1969. My then husband said, well, I'm going to go back to school and get a doctorate in political science, because we had just moved here, and he began to realize that in D.C. you needed that if you were going to continue. And so he was a lawyer, but he was interested in doing that. So you need to go out and get an extra job. Well, I was directing at many different little theater companies, and they were getting, praise God, good reviews. So I was asked to be on a panel, a one-act DC play panel tournament as to who the best director was, who the best actor was, blah, 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 lighting designer. And I found myself on this panel with this woman named Alfredine Brown, who had done many films, was quite brilliant. And We hit it off. And she turned to me and asked if I had my master's. And I said, yes, I do, from Boston University in the late 50s. And she said, well, are you interested in teaching acting? And I thought, oh, a job offer. That's what I'm supposed to be doing here. So I'll say yes. So I said, yes. So she said, well, go down and see my husband. He's chair of the theater arts department. And how would you? The rest is history. So that's how that went down. Now, at Howard, aside from the fact that the students, when I arrived in 69, remember Dr. King had been assassinated in 68. So when I arrived in 69, aside from the fact that the students and the faculty made clear that they didn't want a person of my color there, I began to realize that there was a disconnect between me and them because of what history had done to Black Americans. They were behind, not in talent, not in passion, not in awareness, but they were behind in reading good plays. They were behind in having gone to the theater. The movies they watched were very few and far between at that time, and they had very few people of color in them in the late 60s and early 70s. So I really began to realize in retrospect what enslavement had tangibly meant to the Black American. And it became evident to me in all sorts of ways. Who was Tennessee Williams, Laurence Olivier Watt, and also kind of movies they went to. And also, very few people had anybody in their family, very few, there were some, who had graduated college. And college was not an option. Therapy, and I'm not talking about physical therapy, was not an option. Those things were not happening. And I began to realize what a disconnect there was from my world and theirs. Now, while I was facing discrimination on my own, tires slashed, called all sorts of honky names, etc., it occurred to me that this was really what I was supposed to be doing. In other words, I had had a privileged life, and I had been raised an only child, an only adopted child, by my mother and father, who were always saying, give back, give back, give back. Now, I think they meant to the Jewish community, but one of the tenets of Judaism was repair the world. Tikkun, repair the world. Tikkun, which we shout on Yom Kippur. So I was putting all this together slowly and trying to dodge the general bullets that were coming at me, like a faculty member saying to me, you must go to the beauty parlor every day. And I said, why do you say that? I didn't even know her. She said, well, you just look that way. I didn't know what that meant. And later on, you know, I would put together slowly, it had something to do with my hair, it had something to do that I didn't have to straighten it. But, you know, that was my learning curve, okay? But that's what I was getting sent at the same time that I was figuring out that these kids needed me and I needed them because they had passion, they had smarts, they had street wisdom, they had ability to work physically, which was not true of the training I had received. And it was not true of all the generally, this is a generalization, of most of the white actors I had worked with. You had to coach them into movement. Here, you didn't need to coach anybody into movement. They got up and they moved at the same time they were talking. So it was terrific. I was enjoying it. I was learning a lot. I was expanding a lot. And I was saying to myself, this is what I should be doing. This is what I need to be doing. This has something to do with repairing the world in a little way, in a teeny way. So that kept me there. And that answers your question. That kept me there for 32 years. 32. I was let go twice. I wouldn't say fired. I was told after the first year, you see, I was hired late August. So they threw me in there because they needed someone. You know, that's classes were starting and they didn't have anybody. And so then at the end of that, they didn't need me anymore. So they told me, thank you so much. You know, oh, yes, you've got very good reports from the students. We've read your questionnaires and they all think you make things very clear and you've worked with them intimately. And oh, yes, but we don't need you anymore. And I said, no, I'm not going, not going. So after that, they said, well, because they saw I could be a problem, which I didn't even envision at the time. What I just envisioned was, I want to stay here. I'm learning a lot. And the students are learning a lot. So I want to stay. It's a double binder here. So they calmed down and they said, well, okay, you'll be evaluated at the seventh year and then we'll decide whether you get promoted or not. So I forgot about that and went slugging along and directed Felicia Rashad and Linda Gravatt in a play on stage. And then Felicia decided, oh, this woman knows something. And then, you know, I had already directed off Broadway. And so then, you know, they were all saying, no, no, she's got to stay. And so in time, the second time around, the seventh year, I'll make it tighter. The seventh year, the faculty wanted me, all positive, and the students wanted me. But the chairman wrote that I had left the window open in August on the first floor. I had left it open a crack, and I was endangering property. Computers had just come in. And that was the first thing he put in my letter, which I didn't know about until. And the second thing was I was taking a job away from another person of color. Now, the truth of the matter was that at that time, there weren't too many black people who had masters in acting and directing and theater. Because if you were going to go for a master's and pay that kind of money, which nobody had, you weren't going to study theater. You're going to study computers, which was coming in and, you know, which is what everybody did. So that was ridiculous. But anyway, I got that case. And after that, I was in lockstep and I was a tenured professor. And then I was not a nervous wreck about all these. And I knew what these comments were at that time. And, you know, I worked it out. And people stopped it because they saw what I could give. And I made wonderful friends on the faculty and of the students. And I think of them all fondly and they keep up with me and I keep up with them. And I'm so proud of what they've accomplished. So, so proud. Because what my aim became once I didn't have to worry about whether people were going to listen to me or not, was I wanted them to tell their stories, Kimberly, their way, and be on screen, whether that meant TV or film or stage, and present who they were, who people of color are from their own perspective, not with a white director, not with a white playwright, not in the small roles of somebody's mammy, you know, but I wanted that very strongly underneath because I was part of a group of people as a Jew who all changed their names to be on the screen. And nobody knew that Kirk Douglas was, or Anthony Curtis. Nobody knew who was Jewish. Well, why does it matter? Well, because then we weren't represented. We were giving you good actors, but who were we? So I understood that about Black people. Yours is a more visible culture, and ours is more invisible. There are pros and cons to both. Some, you know, cause more problems. Some can help be more helpful, you know. Passing, of course, in your community has occurred. So I wanted that presentation of the wonderful people that I was working with and come to know, and by extension, other Black people, I wanted them represented correctly or in a rounded, not stereotype fashion. And so I worked hard. I still work hard at that. Work hard in my living room. I work hard when I teach anywhere on Zoom. Whenever I do workshops anywhere, and I just did one at the Apollo in January in New York, I'm wanting them to present themselves. Now, the thing about presenting yourself is you still need technique. You know, before you can paint that purple, red, pink barn that Edward Hopper would do or some other painter, you have to be able to realistically draw the barn and know the composition and the light and what colors do what on canvas and how to work with if it's watercolor or how to the technique of working with oils. Before you can get up and dance in any dance, you have to know ballet techniques because you know have to move your legs and your arms and your torso and so forth. So I was pushing technique at the same time that I was working with Black material. People have always asked me, well, I mean, what did you know about Black material? How come you were working with Black material? Well, I was just, they were presenting it and I was pulling it out of them. It was in them, but then they had to take technique. And to this day, technique is hard for all actors, white, Black, Asian, whatever. Because if you've taken the first unit, which we call beats, of your scene and you're yelling, you can't keep yelling the whole scene. Audiences don't want to pay for that. They don't want to watch it on TV. They'll turn it off and go to the next channel. They'll go to the bathroom or they'll get the popcorn in the movie theater. They'll stand on that long line because, well, what's he doing in there? Well, he's on screen yelling. Do you know, audiences want to see variety. And now we move into vulnerability of a character and a versatility of an actor, all those V's. And then we go into, well, what's his reason for yelling? What does he want? What's he fighting for? What's standing in his way? And then we begin to analyze the script and we begin to, what's the word, structure the script. And we look at the script differently than just, I'll say this line and that line and this line and that line and this. And then we have to learn how to work with language. And if we're not used to saying a lot of words in a line in our lives, but we got a long sentence with a lot of words in it, well, there's a technique there. So that's what I was doing. And that coupled with, we had some wonderful, my colleagues at that time were wonderful, Glenda Dickerson, Mike Malone, who founded the Duke Ellington School of the Arts in Washington, where I later went on to teach for 24 years. Well, we had some terrific teachers. So coupled with that, that's why that group, those 10 years there, produced an Anthony Anderson, produced Debbie Allen, a Felicia Rashad, produced a Lynn Whitfield, and I could go on as to ending in 1999 with Chadwick Boseman, the Black Panther, because they were hungry and we were giving them technique and they were smart and they were starting to apply it. And then they could go out and represent their community in a way that gave me nachas, joy. Nachas, a Yiddish word for bragging, for joy. So, and there's still, I just read, somebody sent me an email, Tracy Toms, who starred in the original production of Rent. Tracy Toms, she'll be coming out in a new play, I forgot the name of it, on Broadway next fall. So, was an unusual time. I thought at the time, this is how being old helps. At the time, I thought, this is the worst time for a white person to be teaching at Howard. I mean, Dr. King has just been assassinated. Washington is all burned up. I would drive past all these stores that were gutted. What am I doing here? I would say to myself. I called Dr. Mel Sloan, who I had studied film with in LA at UCLA and USC. I called him in a outside telephone booth. That's the year it was. And I said to him, Dr. Sloan, what am I doing here? I was one of his pet students. I only studied with him part-time with film. So what am I doing here? Will we see any Black people on screen? I mean, you taught George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. You should know. Will we see any Black people on screen? What are we? I said, am I setting them up for the breadlines? Because my father was always talking about the breadlines of the 30s and the 40s. And I'm old enough to remember hearing all that all the time. I said, I don't want to set these wonderful people up for the breadlines. Am I doing anything here? And he said to me, the trucks were rumbling. I was saying, could you speak louder? The trucks were rumbling. And he said, you have been privileged. There it was. At the time, the word didn't hit me the way now it does, but it hit me. And you have had an opportunity that they haven't had. And in time, it will change. And I know you, Vera, I know you have a way with words. You have a way with working with people. I've seen that in school. And you will, in time, help. And I said, well, do you really think that? Because I don't want to be a part of setting people up for nothing. He said, it's going to change. It has to, he said. I said, all right, Dr. Sloan. I hung up and I went back in the classroom and kept at it, despite Taraji Henson's hands on her hips saying to me in class, you don't know me. You don't know my people. You don't have anything to say to me. And the class was like, and I said, okay, Miss Henson, I understand where you're coming from. Now, do you want to learn how to make this monologue better? Or do you just want to scream and carry on for the whole thing? Do you think people want to watch that for how long? And I said to the class, do you want to watch her scream and carry on? And they said, well, no, great.
not exactly.
Yeah.
So, wow, Vera.
So in time, she wrote in her memoir, when she wrote a memoir about 6 years ago, she actually wrote this down. And it was true that I had said to her in class, Miss Henson, you look really fly. I learned that from the kids. In your thigh-high red leather boots and matching jacket, but you still can't act. And I said, oh, yes, I did say that, didn't I? And she wrote that in the book. She said, this short red-haired woman from New York gave me the hardest time. And she said, and then that quote, you know, so I cut her no slack. And years later, when we reconciled, well, every time she came to Howard, she called my name as one of the teachers who made an impact on her. And she said in the book, page 87, that she likes to think that her success in her career was due to three people, and I'm one of the three, and she mentions one. Despite the fact that we had this little thing going on, you know? Well, I felt if I could get to her, because she came from an area in D.C. that was difficult, and she had been through a difficult situation. Father, I think, was murdered, either her father or her boyfriend, I can't remember which. And she was angry, daring and talented, but angry all the time, you know. And then she came to Howard, the capstone of Black education. And there she was in charge of her acting, her major. She had Vera Katz. I mean, this was not good. I understood that.
How did I end up here?
Yes, I understood it. I mean, I could feel it. I think because I'm a minority, or I don't like that word, but because I'm of a diverse group of people that have been discriminated against, I could feel it. I could understand how she felt. So we got there, but she was the toughest of them all to open up. But we got, and she's still tough out there, you know. I can say now, the beauty of being old, I can say, well, it wasn't just me. She's still tough. She's tough with Oprah. So what did I expect? Right?
Right.
I mean, if she could be tough with Oprah, for God's sakes, you know, Vera Katz is nothing. You see my point? So,
of course.
Be old enough to learn that. You know, I had to go through the decades and check it out and hold it up and understand it. That's the beauty of aging. You can put everything, not everything, but most of your life in perspective, you know? And I guess what I come to is there's some sort of plan for your life. And you can either follow it or do your own plan, but you've got to have a plan. And I think that through it all, God was telling me, the reason nobody, for example, the second time, 1976, when I had to take a year off from school to fight a case, second case, not one of the faculty, my faculty, or the faculty I had worked with in the College of Fine Arts, I had interfaced with set designers from the art department, I had interfaced with the music department, I had gone up and done acting workshops for the choir, you know, in other words, feel the words rather than just stand there and sing them, you know, that kind of thing. And so I gotten to know a lot of people by then. And I was one of maybe three of my color in the building. So they got to know me. But I was so hurt because nobody contacted me the whole year that I couldn't work because I was involved with campus. No faculty member contacted me. And at some point I said, let it go. There must be a reason. Just let it go. And then I forgot about it. And the day I came back, the secretary, who had been a friend and been there forever, said, oh, I'm so glad you're back. And I said, oh, thank you, Miss Janet. And she said, well, you can clean out your box now. Your cubby is exploding. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, wait a minute, I have a bag. She came out with a big bag. I have things for you. Well, who are they? What's this? She said, well, they're from the whole faculty. And I went home and I read these letters. And it was, I'm so sorry this is happening to you, but my daughter is on remission of tuition in the science building, science department, and I can't afford to do anything that might endanger that. Well, she couldn't come here. She couldn't go to college at all. Another one. I made the woman in charge of ceramics. I made this pendant for you because I know you like big showy things. And I'm praying for you every day to Jesus, but I cannot get involved, dear Vera, because we just bought a farmhouse out in some place, and and all our money is going there in between my job and my husband. And I began to say, oh my goodness, you know, simple little notes like, I'm glad you're back. I'd like to take you to lunch on blah, blah. And so it was very clear that when you're young, you tend to be judgmental and rush to judgment. And even that lesson in 77, when I came back, said to me, see, there were reasons. And everybody was like, wonderful. After that, I was just sailing through it all. So it was a plan. In my
book, if we could, you know, break that down a little bit, because you've said so much. I could sit here and listen to you all day. And I do have just some follow-up questions. I
mean, go ahead.
When you're talking about people that they were writing you and you weren't aware of that, and you had a different version of the story, and obviously people were afraid. And I want to ask you, because your time there at Howard initially wasn't a bed of roses. There was a lot of drama and problems and slash cars. Were you afraid? And if so, how did you persevere through that?
Well, there was one time there were two times. The first time was because somebody with a knife, a switchblade at my throat. But he didn't understand that the critique I had just given, he wasn't registered. He was some guy who wandered in from the street. See, they didn't have the security then, which was a reason I never reported him. Because if I reported it, Howard would have gotten into lots of... But those days, of course, now you go on the campus, there's all sorts of, press this button here, there's all sorts of, you know, security.
Right.
But we were in the middle of the city, and homeless people were sleeping downstairs in the music practice rooms. And downstairs, we had just done my end of the year directing scenes. And at the end of which, the classmates give critiques, and then the teacher gives the critique. And we start with what was really great about your scene, Mika, was blah, blah, blah. And really, class, did you notice that his blocking? Yes, boo, boo, boo. And then we get to him. So this guy sat and watched the scene, and the scene was Ed Bullen's In the Wine Time, which is a bunch of people sitting around on the steps of a row house drinking wine and talking trash. And I'm not saying it's bad play. I'm just saying that that's what's going on. And how dare this white woman get up and critique that from this young man's point of view, right? He thought it was terrific. He thought it was life. He thought it was reality TV before reality TV. Mm-hmm. He didn't know. He wandered in and watched, you know. He wasn't even sure those kids were actors. He thought it was all the whole thing. So he was very upset. And God knows what else he had going on in his life.
Right.
And so as I went off to the bathroom down a passageway, I felt a blade.
Wow.
And yes, I was scared, and I didn't have to go to the bathroom after that incident because I was scared. Yes, because I was afraid. Yeah.
Wow.
And after all the mother, the MFs, and he wanted me to say, fortunately, he gave me lines that I could hear. And the lines were, you know, you had no right. Who were you? You made a mistake. And I said, yes, I made a mistake. Yes, I had no right. Yes, I was wrong. Yes, I said all those things he wanted me to say. And then he took the blade away, and I never saw his face.
Wow.
And he was gone.
Wow.
And then I went to the bathroom. The class was waiting for me to come back. And I had to dry myself out there somehow so that I wouldn't look like, you know, I had just made my pants. And I went back to class and taught again. I never talked about it. Number one, I hadn't been there that long, and it would not have been helpful to me. Number two, it would have shown in the newspaper that Howard didn't have good security. Now, the mistake I made finally when I'm leaving in 2001 was the journalist asked me that question that you asked me. And I said, oh, yes, once. And I told her shorthanded. Do you know she led the story about me retiring? She led the story in the Washington Post about me retiring with that incident. So I learned, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And if it makes people look bad, whatever the group of people, they'll lead with that. I was so upset. My colleagues called me. They were, because it looked, I betrayed them. It looked like, you know, so that was a wrong move I made. I learned about how to talk to the press.
Let me ask you this, because you know, I know when you made that decision, you know, not to reveal that incident, there was a lot to think about, the reputation of the school. And if that were to happen to you today, would you take the same course of action, or would you do something different? Let's say you were the same age this time period. Would you take that same course of action, or would you think through?
Well, it depends on my reputation. My reputation now is I've put in all these years, people know who I am, and you know, I probably would speak up. I don't know, you know. Our chairman, one of our chairmen, the one who wrote that bad thing about me, no less, he died in a terrible, horrific way, and we made the newspaper. He was involved with a woman, and the husband who she was estranged from, well, she thought she was estranged from him, but obviously he didn't. He followed them, and long story short, he killed them.
Wow.
The chairman ended up in the trash bin trying to hide. And so why am I telling you this terrible story? He'd been a chairman for a long time. The boys loved him. The young, I say boys, I don't mean disparagingly. I mean the younger students, the male students, that's what I should have said.
The males.
Love them, yes. Well, so then they had to do a thing about it on TV. And they came in on TV, and they wanted to interview Vera Katz because she had been there with him for a long time, and another teacher. And the minute they started to ask about how long did he know this woman? Who was this woman? Did you know this woman? She was a little young for him, wasn't he? And blah, blah, blah. I put my hand up. No. We're here to talk about Mr. C. And he was a wonderful teacher. He always made sure that we did really new Black plays every year. I don't know where he found them, but they were very interesting. I know that he sometimes even lent students money to stay here. and blah, blah. That's all I'm going to say about him. Now, I'm not saying anything else. And I, if you continue in this vein, I'm leaving the interview. Well, I felt I was in a position of more strength then because I was a well-ensconced faculty member. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
And I got up like I was going, and then they changed the, you know.
You know, Vera, in all the conversations that we've had so many, I could literally listen to you all day long. You know, one of the things that I really get from you is you have a lot of courage and a lot of chutzpah. I mean, you really put yourself out there in ways that a lot of people might hesitate in doing. And I remember your story about writing. Was it Edward Albee?
Yeah.
If you could share that story, because I think it inspired me, and I'm sure it'll inspire others as well.
Oh, well, it was 2001, and I had decided that it was time for me to leave. I had an opportunity to go over to the high school, the arts high school. It was going to be a different kind of work, and I wasn't going to be full time, but I figured I could give the students something. So the chairman wanted me to direct Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because I had done The Rhinoceros, which is also Theater of the Absurd by Ionesco. And so she felt I could do that kind of thing. So before I left, I should do that. Well, I said, I don't think it's relevant to anybody in the kids, the co-eds. I mean, I would sit in the audience and know who the co-eds were and what they, you know. And she said, oh, no, you must do it. I insist you do it, and blah, blah. So I read the thing, and of course, it was a great play. It won the Pulitzer Prize. But there weren't any Black references. And people like to hear about themselves. I mean, you know, you want to see a play that's relevant to you. So I wrote down on pages of paper in longhand. The computer had just come in, but I didn't know how to use it. My husband was already a whiz at it. And I asked him if he'd help me with the letter. He said, no, you're going to write one of these long letters. And this was my second husband. So I wrote in longhand to Mr. Albee, who I never met in my life, nor did I know. I've seen his plays, of course. Page 36. The character who is a professor has taught at all these universities. They're all white. Need to be replaced with Black universities. Page 24. And I went on. Now, did I know his address? No, I just opened up. And this should tell anybody that people are reachable if they think it's of interest to them and if it can be of help to them. On the, you know, after the first page, you always say any inquiries can be given to Mr. Albee's agent. So that's what I did. I sent it. My husband said, you will never hear from him. Never, ever.
Never hear a peep.
So there I am in the closet looking for the mate to my red leather boot, trying to be like a Taraji type, you know? And the phone rings and I run and get it and I hear a Professor Katz. He had a slightly British accent, which I thought was sort of phony. Edward Albee here, he said. I said, oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Sure, pal.
Now, you better be at rehearsal on time, because I was trying to get dressed to go to rehearsal. And then there was a silence. I said, okay, who are you? There was again a silence, and then it was, Edward Albee here. And something said, uh-oh, wait a minute. Either this kid is a very good imitation or what?
Or it really is him.
Mr. Albee? He said, yes, that's what I've been saying. He was ready. Oh, my God. So he said, all right, now get your script. You have your script handy. I said, oh, yes. He said, now you say on page 36, well, what are the other Black universities?
Wow.
2001.
Wow.
I said, well, we could start with Tuskegee, or we could do Morehouse. Okay, he's writing it all down. And I'm thinking, he's writing this down. He's what?
And then he's listening to me.
Yeah. And then he says, okay, now the blonde, blue-eyed child. Now, yes, we do have to change that, don't we? Well, I've been thinking the dusky child. Do you think the dusky would work? I said, oh, I think that's wonderful, Mr. Albee. And so, well, we did the whole, all of them. We did, there were more. There were more. At the end of which time he says, I wonder, and he's like hesitant. I think, really? And he says, I wonder if it would be all right if I came and visited the students and told them about the play. Oh, my God.
Did you nearly pass out?
So then we went through a roundabout because he was going to jog over from the Kennedy Center where he was getting an award. And he had looked at a map and he knew that the Kennedy Center was located not too far from Howard University. And he loved to jog, so he would jog. And we went around about that because I, in my lack of wisdom, was trying to tell him, no, 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 you can't do that. We'll send a car. Oh, because I was thinking, oh, the president of the university will send a car. And we'll, no, he was going to jog. And then something said to me, Vera, you better shut up or you're going to lose him. I said, all right, Mr. Albee, if you rethink it, let us know, but all right. Thinking, ye gads, he'll probably be dead if he jogs, but he'll figure it out. He arrives in a, I can't remember if it was yellow or pink, I think it was yellow, jogging suit, two hearing aids, so he didn't look like the playwright I thought. And at the front door, I am pacing in my best outfit, and I didn't look like what he thought, because he didn't want my color. He said, Professor Katz. I said, oh, yes. And I got it. I got it. And then I dragged him, this poor old man, because I said, oh, God, he's got two hearing aids. Wait, the kids see this. And I'm thinking, and I pulled him down the hall and shoved him into where all the Howard University students were. And he walked in and they all applauded, praise God. And he was so happy. And I began to realize as the whole afternoon went on that if people want to get something, they'll answer the letter. He wanted to come to a Black university. He wanted to say he had done that, and he wanted to have his play done there, and he wanted to meet Black young students because he knew that was the future. He was a good playwright. He understood that. And the chairman had somebody drag up the King Henry VIII chair and dust it off so that he could sit on it. And the silver pitcher, which was a prop in the play, I remember thinking, does that thing actually hold water? Because it was a prop in the play. She had it polished up. She was like a little mother running around. I never saw her that way. Oh, Mr. Albee. Oh, my goodness. I hope you don't mind. I've only invited one person, the Washington Post. And he blanched. And he looked at me. And I thought, oh, God, this isn't going well. He's going to leave. And she said, oh, well, you know, we are just so proud to have you here. And he looked at her. And I smiled at him. Because he didn't like the press, you know, and he didn't want it. Well, then he said, Professor Katz, then I became his conspirator. He said, I'd like the students to stand up in a semicircle. So I thought he was going to give them an acting exercise. I mean,
what are we doing?
Yes. I said, oh, of course. And so I told them, they all stood up in a... And he went around, I mean, it was like two different styles. And he shook, put his hand out, and he shook each person's hand, said, I'm Edward Albee. Now, who are you? And she said, I'm Jaquina Jones. Whom are you playing? Oh, I'm playing. So that's a big role for you. And he went around to each person because he felt laying his hands on them was important for him and maybe for them. And so already he's established a different style, not one they were used to. You know what I mean?
Of course.
And he sat down and he delivered a brilliant lecture. Now, do you realize I kill myself about this every day? We didn't record it because we weren't techies in those days. We just weren't. She knew enough for the Henry VIII chair and the silver pitcher, but
Nothing beyond that.
no.
Any
And
pictures? Were you able to get pictures?
yes. And one was in the Washington Post. I have it hanging on my wall. We still have those pictures. One is in my book with him and the students. And while we're standing there next to the students, he says, Professor Katz, and I read his mind. He wanted to stand in the group next to the student, not next to me. And I said, oh, yes. So I went in the corner, but I was there in the picture. But, at the end of the lecture, which was brilliant, and oh, here's the interesting thing. It was in the green room, which is, a small room. By the end, all the faculty members from music on the third floor, art on the fourth floor, everybody had gotten wind. I heard it from the grapevine. Everybody had gotten wind that Edward Albee was in the building. And they all came down and sat there and listened to him, his lecture. I mean, it was like wonderful, we hadn't sent out flyers or anything, and there they were. So at the end, the few students who remembered to bring the script, which I told them not to bring the Xerox copy, right? He autographed. I hope they realize this day what it's worth, But he autographed, he just said Edward Albee, So then he comes over and he whispers to me, Professor Katz, now what are you doing now? So I thought, oh, we're going to go to a fancy lunch and I'm all dressed up. I said, well, nothing. He said, good, you can show me around the campus.
I need a tour, campus tour.
That's what he wanted.
Wow.
He wanted to know the Charles Drew Hall, and he turned to me. Oh, plasma, blood plasma. I said, yes, Mr. Albee. Everywhere we went, Harriet Tubman, of course. But then I said to him, maybe you'd like to see this wonderful painting we have in the back of our theater, because he hadn't been in the theater, of Ira Aldridge. He said, oh, the great Negro tragedian. I said, well, yes, the Shakespeare tragedian. He said, oh, yes, Shakespeare tragedy. And we went, and I turned a light on, and he saw the theater, and he stood there a long time. And of course, we didn't have cell phones. He didn't take a picture. Nowadays, he would have taken a picture in front of the great, but he looked at a long time. And I said, he had to go to London to get work. And Mr. Albee said, yes, I do remember reading that. And I said, he was knighted in Britain. And he said, oh, yes, so yeah. So, well, at the end, he pumped my hand up and down vigorously and said, thank you for this afternoon. Thank you. And he went home. Oh, I said to him, I'm still worrying about these changes and we're going to do the production. So I said, I will need a little statement from you to put on the program, sir. She said, oh, definitely, we'll send that along. We'll send that. I said, it would be wonderful if you could come. He said, well, I would have liked to have been there because this is the first. Did he say black? I don't know. I think he said African American production of my play. Now, many had been done by this time, 2000. But I'm opening Sylvia, which was the play about the goats. Shouldn't do very well, but I wish you such luck, Professor Katz. And then the end of the story is, and this shows you what he wanted from it. My husband's reading the paper from beginning to end, and he says, "Oh, your man is in the paper." I said, "Who's my man?" He said, "Miss Dobby, of course." I said, "All right, we'll ignore that remark." He said, "Well, look, there's a picture." He was handing out money for a playwriting award that he had only 3 years ago started, a playwriting award, the Edward Albee. And the picture was him handing a check of $1,000 to a black young man. And I just
Amazing.
failed because
Fear.
I knew that he had gone home and thought about it. Plus, I knew he had told all his friends, "Oh, yes, I went to Howard, and hasn't met many students in it," and blah, and, you know. So that's what he wanted. And that's okay because we got what we wanted. Now,
100%.
here's the end of the story. And this is so beautiful. Most people don't know this story. When he died about 3 or 4 years ago, I was called by somebody from the estate of Edward Albee. "Professor Vera Katz, blah, blah. Well, I don't teach at Howard anymore." "Yes, but did you teach at Howard during the—" Yes. "Well, Mr. Albee has put in his will," because he had a very long will, "that because of Howard University, Department of Theater Arts, Professor Vera J. Katz, he is giving permission to any version of color, any color, for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf."
Wow.
And do you know, just last week, I
Wow.
received a postcard from the theater in Baltimore, Arena Players, it's called. And they're doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And there's a picture. And do you know, the one who's playing the lead, George, the male, is an Asian American.
Wow. Vera strikes again. I mean, Vera, and
It's
listening to your
something.
To your tales, I think one of the things that really comes to me is you're a risk taker. You're like, I'm going to write this letter. I don't know how it's all going to turn out. And years down the line, it's this unimaginable.
They don't know that they got the rights to do it because if you've read stuff, I'm trying to remember who wrote Crap's Last Tape. He's refused to allow people of color do his play. Oh my God, I'll think of it. It's a very famous play. Oh, the one about God, G-O-D, Waiting for Godot.
Waiting for Godot. Beckett? Samuel
Beckett.
Beckett?
Well, Beckett has refused to allow people of color to do any of his shows.
Wow.
They sued some company that was attempting to. Okay. Now, maybe it's changed a couple of years back. I remember reading that. Maybe it's changed. But Albee had obviously not until he came to Howie. But you
Because of
see,
Vera Katz's letter.
he was a playwright. He wanted to realize what the future was. He was aware that things were going to change. He was in his mid-80s and he was aware and he wanted to take a look and see what this university looked like. Maybe he thought we were intense. I mean, God knows what he thought. And he was like, "Wow, this is terrific."